Good morning, and welcome to the First Parish Church of Stowe in Acton, a welcoming Unitarian Universalist congregation. My name is Rick King, and I'm the chair of the Committee on Ministry. Our minister, Reverend Tom Rossiello, is on sabbatical. The worship service today will be led by Janet Parsons. Janet is currently serving as the intern minister at First Parish in Waltham. She is a graduate of Andover Newton Theological School and is planning for her ordination in March. Janet's call to the Unitarian Universalist ministry evolved over the past several years through active lay leadership as a staff member at a local UU church and through extensive service work in the Gulf Coast in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. She is devoted to her two young adult sons, to Unitarian Universalism, and to fostering and sustaining community and connections across boundaries. Welcome, Janet. And now, as community is so important to all of us here at First Parish Church, please take a moment to greet your neighbor and reach out to visitors who may be with us today. Thank you.
We have gathered the elements of our lives, aware and unaware. We have carried them to this place, the joy of waking and living, the pleasure found in meaningful work, the blush of health, the pain of illness, the grief of loss, and the gift of love. Some of these we have carried a long way. Some have bent our backs until our eyes could no longer see the horizon. Some have carried us upward with purpose, feathered wings in flight. All we have carried through the seasons of our lives has brought us here, to this place we make sacred by our coming together and reciting these gathering words, "Come, you are welcome here." Now the Plascon family will come forward to light our chalice. And I invite you all to recite the words of the chalice lighting written in your order of service. We light one flame from another, and neither light is diminished. So too do we offer caring and love to one another, spreading the light of love from hand to hand, person to person, never depleting the source. Thank you. Our opening hymn this morning is number 346 in the Gray Hymnal, "Come Sing a Song with Me." I invite you to stand as you are able and to, after the hymn is finished, to remain standing to recite our covenant and sing our affirmation. You may rise.
Thank you.
Love is the spirit of this church, and service is its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. I have a story for us this morning. It's about hope, and it's about the difference between hoping and wishing, because they're not the same thing. But before I get started on it, I have a question for people. I'm wondering, this might not seem related at first, but does everybody here know how butter is made? Butter? Really? Butter. Is there an answer? You churn it. Yes, of course. Butter is made by taking a container full of cream, shaking it or plunging it or churning it, mixing it as hard as you can so that the fat in the cream clumps together and turns into butter. It's really quite amazing. So to finally get to our story, once upon a time, there were two little frogs. We'll call them Fred and George. And Fred and George were very curious, and they tended to get themselves into trouble. So one day they were hopping around, and they came upon a big container, and it smelled really good, so they hopped up onto the rim of it, and oops, they slipped and fell right in. And it was a big bowl full of cream, heavy cream. And there they were, stuck in the cream, and the sides of the bowl were tall, and they were so slippery that they couldn't get out. And they didn't know what to do. And Fred was very upset. And Fred said, I wish I hadn't climbed up on top of this bowl. I wish I hadn't fallen in. And now I there's nothing to do. This is just horrible. It's hopeless. And so after a while, he said, George, this is hopeless. There's no point. I wish I hadn't done this, but I'm going to just let go now. And so Fred let go of the bowl and sank down into the cream. Now, George was sad that this had happened to Fred. But George would not give up. George said, I have hope that I am going to get out of this cream, and I'm going to do everything that I can to make my hopes come true. And even if I can't get out, I'm going to hope that I die trying. So George started swimming, and he swam, and he swam, and he kicked, and he kicked and swam, and can anybody guess what happened? What? That's right. George kicked so hard and so strong that the cream got thicker and thicker, and all of a sudden, it turned into butter. And there was George sitting on top of a nice mound of yellow butter, and he hopped right out of the bowl. So this week, I'm hoping that you'll be able to think about Fred and George and the differences in their attitudes, and think about the difference between wishing and hoping. Wishing is, I wish I hadn't done that. I wish it were different. Hoping is, I hope that I'm going to be able to fix this. I hope that I'm going to, even if I can't fix it, that I'll keep trying. So remember George, and remember that hope is action. Thank you very much. is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me. Our second reading this morning isn't exactly a reading. I will be paraphrasing the words of Marjorie Williams, a writer for Slate and Vanity Fair, who was diagnosed with liver cancer, stage 4 liver cancer, at the age of 43. Her children were aged 8 and 5. She wrote a memoir called Hit by Lightning, a cancer memoir. And she died in January of 2005 at the age of 47. And Marjorie tells us in the memoir how difficult it was to sustain hope because the medical profession really was not willing to let her hope. She had a terminal diagnosis. She had been given 3 to 6 months to live. And she found that despite this diagnosis and the way that her doctors responded to her, as what she put it, that it was almost as though hope might set fire to the floor and it had to be stamped out over and over again. But that she said she was able to create a garden for herself in her mind in which she could nurture 11 or 12 varieties of hope that changed through the course of her treatment and changed from day to day depending on what was happening and how she felt, and that she could nurture this and keep this alive within herself. And she concluded this segment by saying that there were days or weeks when the chemotherapy just made her completely miserable, and it might last for 5 days or 5 weeks, but that there would come a day when she would get up and feel fine and say, never mind, today is a beautiful day, and I am going to put on a short skirt and high heels and go out and see what today will offer me. Our next hymn is number 1007 in the Teal Hymnal, There's a River Flowing in My Soul.
There's a river.
going to begin my sermon this morning by speaking words that I suspect are very seldom heard here at First Parish, which is that I have a confession to make. I arrived here this morning realizing that I had left behind on my kitchen counter all my materials for worship this morning, hence the reading on the cell phone. And so I have made notes of my sermon, and I'm going to practice delivering it extemporaneously. This is actually a movement among Unitarian Universalist ministers in recent days to be trying to learn to untether themselves from the text and from reading and preaching more from the heart. So we are here on the cutting edge today. So, there was an elderly woman named Armel who I met seated in a wheelchair in a rehab unit where I was doing my chaplaincy training for the summer. Her legs were bandaged and swollen, obviously from arthritis. And she shared with me that she had fallen and her injury had been misdiagnosed and she had a fracture that wasn't healing because she couldn't put any weight on it. And her husband had died not long before. She lived alone, and she was despairing because her insurance was going to run out soon, and she didn't know what was going to happen to her. She wept. Where was she going to go? And my reaction to that was I wanted desperately to leap up and say, hang on just a second. I'm going to go find a social worker or somebody who can actually help you, and I'll be right back. But of course, that was not my job and not my role. And so I stayed with her and talked to her and listened to her. And I discovered that summer, doing my chaplaincy training, that sitting with someone in pain and in sorrow is incredibly difficult because you cannot fix their problems. You're just there to accompany them, be with them, but there's nothing that you can do to fix it. And when you're in a continuing care community, as I was, you're present to the inexorable diminishing of the human lives before you, and you're seeing the response to this truth. I remember another woman with moderate dementia who just snapped at me one day and said, "Don't try to pretend this isn't happening to me. I know what's happening to me." So I learned very quickly that I couldn't fix any of this. And that was hard for me because I try to fix things. First of all, I'm a mom. And I also think I come by fixing things honestly. When my boys were little, they used to bring their broken toys to my father so that he could fix them. And we called him Grampy Fix-It. And so one day in chaplaincy training, one of the other people in my chaplain group referred to me as Ms. Fix-It. I'm sure she meant it in a really loving way. But at any rate, I was thinking a lot about hope at this time when I was doing my chaplaincy training because my marriage was ending. And my husband and I had been working on our marriage for a long time, but we weren't making that much progress. And so finally he came to me one night and he said, "It's gotten better, but it isn't going to be good enough." And I knew he was right. And it had been difficult for a really long time, so I was very surprised at the depth of my grief. I really did grieve terribly. And I realized that there are a great many losses with the ending of a marriage, a long marriage. There's the loss of relationship, the loss of love. But what I also realized was one of the hardest pieces was that there's a loss of hope. You know, you always hold that hope, and then suddenly I knew despair. It was over. And the thing with feathers just seems to go away. It goes so quiet that you can't hear it at times. And you can suffer from depression. You can suffer from despair. and I experienced that myself. But what I also experienced over time was that hope returns. It's really almost miraculous. It comes back faintly at first, but then you can start to feel the fluttering. And when it does come back, it comes back in a different way, in a different form. It evolves. You start out hoping for one thing, and your hopes evolve into something else. For me personally, it was hoping to save my marriage, but then over time, hoping for a whole new life and hoping for my ministry and my relationship with my sons and just all of life that was still ahead of me. I was thinking about this the other day. I was reading the New York Times, and it was announced that Oliver Sacks, the well-known author and neurologist, has terminal cancer. We've heard a great deal about cancer here this morning, so this seems like such an appropriate topic since so many of us are grappling with it in one way or another. And Oliver Sacks shared in the piece that he put in the Times that he was hoping for deepening his relationships for the rest of his life and maybe doing some traveling and some more writing. And it was, I'm wondering if you can hear what it is that I'm trying to get to here with the evolution of hope, that he wasn't hoping for a cure. He's not hoping to live forever, but he's hoping that his life will still have meaning for as long as possible. I saw that with a dear friend who had ALS, who died a year and a half ago. And he started out, of course, he and his family, hoping that there would be a miraculous cure. Of course there wasn't. But his wife shared with me that over time, he hoped every single day. And what he hoped for was to make every day matter. And he did. Now, this is kind of an interesting time to be talking about hope. Here we are in the middle of this winter. It's kind of like we're living in the middle of a giant snow globe. I was sharing with a family member yesterday what my topic was this morning, and there was a pause, and then he started to laugh. And he said, "Is this a parody?" And I thought, when is it more important to be talking about hope than really at a time like this when we are just being assaulted and the world looks so dead, it's colorless. There's just no evidence of life anywhere. And we have to look really hard and dig deep to look for signs of hope right now. For some people, it's you know, pitchers and catchers reporting to spring training. I've been studying the trees, and I can see that the buds are beginning to start to swell on the trees. If you look closely, you can see that. And the birds are really beginning to sing, and the days are getting longer. So even in the midst of this white world that we're living in, there is still hope if we look hard and we find it. Paul wrote in his letter to the Corinthians that the most important things were faith, love, and hope. And I've always wondered why those three. And it has come to me that those are really the life-giving emotions, faith, hope, and love, always. That really is truly the spirit of life. And it is those emotions that is coursing through all of us and just really, you know, pulsing through all of creation. And so we have to hold on to those because those are what are holding us up as we go through life. I'll tell you a story by UU Minister Victoria Safford. She shares a story about a friend who's a psychiatrist and who was doing counseling at a women's college. And she was talking with her friend one day just after a young woman who the doctor had been counseling had committed suicide. And the doctor was grieving, as you can imagine. She was terribly upset. And she told Victoria Safford, "I can't save them, but all I can do is to stand at the gates of hope and beckon them in toward new life and love. Make them want to come toward me. Make them want to come step into this life of hope and to stand at the gates of hope and to do that work over and over and over again. Call out to them. Try to bring them in. And Victoria Safford wrote that she considers this to be what she calls the small work within the great work of creation. And what she's saying is that hope shows up for people when we are present, when we are together, when we are there to share with people, when we're willing to stand there at the gates of hope and to do this work of creation, to sustain life, to sustain love, to sustain hope. I've been thinking about this a lot in the context of what's going on, in current events, thinking about, the 50th anniversary of the March on Selma. And if you've seen the movie or if you remember the event itself, what was so clear was that there was a dark time when it wasn't clear that they were really going to be able to pull this off. And Martin Luther King sent telegrams to white clergy all over the country and asked them to come and join them. And people did, including, some Unitarian Universalists. And so people went down to Selma and they marched arm in arm across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. We saw it a couple years ago in at Justice General Assembly in Phoenix. I don't know if any of you were there, but there was a candlelight vigil out at Tent City, which was the detention center for the undocumented immigrants. And so there were a few thousand of us out there waving electric candles in the dark and chanting, "We are with you. We are with you." And so again, there is that presence, there's that that sense of standing with someone when they need it, offering hope for people who don't have hope of their own right now, waiting for that little fluttering to return to the chest. I've thought a lot about ministry, what the work of ministry is. I used to think that it was to help people make meaning out of their lives, and it is certainly that. And then I thought that it was really all about accompanying people through the difficult times in their lives, and that is certainly a really huge piece of it too. But as I've gone on, I have come to see that ministry really, the most important piece of it, not only for an actual minister, but for all of us religious people who are engaged in community work and work of the church, is to sustain hope. Because in sustaining hope, we are doing this small work of the great work of creation and helping keep hope and life alive. So, my friends, I want to leave you today by saying that hope is ever present, even when we think we can no longer feel that flutter in our souls. Our work is to be the co-creators, to help sustain it, nourish it, nurture it, fan the flames a little bit, keep it coming. And we keep this hope alive by being with others, helping them to hold the whole wobbly mess of their human lives until they can breathe and stand on their own again. And may we all be called to this work to sustain life and to sustain the creation. Amen, and blessed be. Our closing hymn is number 344 in the Gray Hymnal, "A Promise Through the Ages Rings." now may you go forth from this sacred place of comfort and sanctuary into the cold world, bringing with you the light and hope and peace that you find here. May you go in peace. Amen.